You're listening to episode 3 of the Book Thingo podcast, recorded on August 17, 2013, at the Romance Writers of Australia conference in Fremantle. Book Thingo would like to acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which this episode was recorded, the Whadjuk people. We also acknowledge the contributions of Aboriginal Australians to our shared literary heritage. Coming up on this episode, Julia Quinn talks about Tim Tams, the Bridgertons, the challenges of writing books with overlapping timelines, the appeal of epilogues, the sum of all kisses and the Smythe-Smith characters, humour in romance, and historical accuracy in a romance novel.
Welcome to the Book Thingo podcast, talking about books we love, especially romance. Kill a fairy fast on the Book Thingo podcast.
Welcome to the third episode of the Book Thingo podcast. I'm Kat Mayo from Book Thingo, an Aussie blog for romance readers. You can find me, along with my six fabulous co-bloggers, at bookthingo.com.au. In this episode, I chat with Julia Quinn, who was in Australia a couple of years ago for the Romance Writers of Australia conference in Fremantle. If you haven't already read her Bridgerton series, it's a must read, especially if you like Regency romance. But even if you don't, let me say that I have lured readers into historical romance through Julia's books. If I sound composed at all in this podcast, all credit goes to our audio producer, Rudy Bremer, because I'm pretty sure I was in a heightened state of nervousness and delight for the entire interview. You can find information on all the books we mention in this episode by going to bookthingo.com.au/podcast and clicking on episode number 3.
Are there any unfriendly Australians? I've had such a marvelous time here. I think most of the authors and editors who come to this conference incorporate a holiday with it, and some do it after the conference, some do it before. So I've had the opportunity to travel around a bit beforehand, which is nice because I'm not jet lagged, which is one thing. But I've just already had a chance to see, I was supposed to say so much of the country, I mean, which is actually a very small amount, but enough to just know that I want to come back and see more. I've had such a wonderful time.
So is this the first time you've been to Australia?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And I've traveled fairly extensively, but I just have never made it quite this far.
It is pretty far. Yeah. Let's talk about the Bridgertons, because the Bridgertons are how I discovered your books. It's a really long series. And then you came out with the second epilogues for mm-hmm. them. I just wanted to ask you how you got the idea for the Bridgertons, why you picked so many siblings. It seems to be just like a recurring theme in many of your books where you have big families, if not siblings, then the cousins and mm-hmm. relatives.
Well, I have a lot of fun writing sibling relationships. I think nobody can get under your skin like a brother or sister, and nobody can joke with you in quite the same way, and nobody can humiliate you in as good-natured a manner. And I think that when you see people with their siblings, it gives you a really good insight into who they are. And in one of my books, I'll get back to the part about how the whole thing began, but in The Viscount Who Loved Me, which is the second Bridgerton book, there's a scene which may be one of my favorite scenes ever that I've written, and certainly one of the top scenes I hear from readers that they liked, which was the Pall Mall game, which is the sort of the vicious croquet right. game. And that wasn't originally even in the book. What happened was I was writing the book, and after you've written a number of books, you sort of get a sense if things are moving too fast. And it's not so much that you're like, ooh, you know, I'm on page 100, they need to kiss. It's not quite like that, but you look along and you're going, yeah, And so what I thought was, well, if I'm too far along in the story, probably I've missed something. So anyway, so I was going along, and I realized that I was writing this story where the hero and heroine really didn't like each other at the beginning. Right. And one of the things the tropes I've never liked about within the romance genre is the I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. Oh my gosh, why can't you tell that I love you? I mean, I think the whole hate to love idea is wonderful, but you got to actually show how it happens. You can't, you know, it's otherwise, I think you're just a stalker. I don't know.
Yeah, it's creepy.
It's creepy. So I realized that I had gone, I hadn't quite gone from hate to love, but I didn't know that you know, I'd reached this point in the writing where they actually were kind of like, they liked each other. It wasn't love yet, but they were starting to respect each other. And I realized that I hadn't really given enough to show why. And I thought, well, what would be the best way for Kate, the heroine, to realize that Anthony, the hero, is actually a good person? And it occurred to me she had to see him with his family because that's such an important thing to him. And so I put them all in this, she ended up joining the infamous Bridgerton Pall Mall game, and she could see the way he interacted with his siblings. And, it, you know, it wasn't like they were all lovey-dovey at all. I mean, they were just viciously competitive, but you could see the love. And so that's how the scene ended up in the book. And I think that scene is really kind of emblematic of what I love about writing siblings, because it's one, it just gives me an opportunity to write really funny scenes, which I love to do, but also a different way to illuminate a person's character. And especially when it's a scene where the other character can witness this type of interaction, I think it just really increases depth of the characterization. But getting back into how the whole series came about, I didn't intend to write an 8-book. I can't imagine ever intending to write an 8-book series. But
how does that work?
Well, I just started writing The Duke and I, which was the first book. And for whatever reason, I wanted her to be from a large family, and I gave her 7 siblings, so a family of 8, and kind of had some fun with it. And I thought I'll write a trilogy because for no other reason than, you know, that's kind of what you did. Everybody wrote trilogies. And so I thought, okay, I wrote one about her, and I'll write the older brother, and I'll write one of her other brothers. So I think I was going to do Daphne and Anthony and Colin, because he sort of ended up in The Duke and I being the most developed of the secondary siblings. Then my editor said, no, just do 2 books, because what happens with trilogies is that the middle one's always kind of lame, because people get really excited about, the author gets really excited about the first book, and then there's always this one character everybody wants to read about, and the second one's kind of filler. And I said, well, I really, really want to do these, you know, both these 2 characters. And so I convinced her, and she said, okay. And so by the time The Duke and I came out, I was pretty much done writing The Viscount Who Loved Me, and I was getting prepared to write the 3rd book of the trilogy, and the book really took off. So I went back to her, and I said, you know, before I write the book about... So I said, do you want me to write a book about Benedict, because it's his older brother, so logically that would be the next one if I were to write about that sibling. And we'd already had such great response to the whole Lady Whistledown thing, and people were excited, and they're like, yes, write him. Okay, so then I put Colin on the back burner and wrote that book, and then in which I put one of my favorite scenes I've ever written, which was the scene about Colin and Penelope in An Offer from a Gentleman, which, you know, he says something horrifyingly terrible about her that, I mean, he doesn't know that she's there. And so, you know, that set that up nicely.
But book 3 is really interesting because when I read it, I didn't think it had the same kind of tone as the first 2.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the one that made me cry out of all the books in the series. But it's also the book that I remember the least. Mm-hmm. All I remember is that it made me cry, so therefore it was a really good book.
Okay.
Like emotionally, it was really... the most powerful for me, probably. Mm-hmm. But the one I always remember is Colin.
You know, I think that maybe... I think the books often that people remember the most are the ones that have certain very, very vivid or different scenes. Right. I think people remember scenes more than overall books. And I'm actually very pleased by what you just said, because one of my biggest goals as a writer is to make sure that I don't write the same book over and over again and just sort of change out the names and certain plot points. And I think that's an easy trap to fall into in any kind of genre fiction. I always tell people, you know, we don't have a formula. You're not just plugging things in, but you do have parameters. If you're writing a romance, they have to meet or re-meet or somehow, and it has to end happily. And how you get from the beginning to the end is up to you. But because of those parameters, it is easy, I think, for authors to fall into certain patterns. And I really don't want to do that, because I will always have my voice and my style, and my books will always have some humor in it and be heavy on dialogue, but I really try hard to shake things up. And it's usually in the types of characters that I do, or in some ways how I write the book. So to hear that you have different type of reactions and different sort of things that you remember about books is really, it tells me that I'm doing my job well.
Oh, you're doing it very well.
Oh, thank you. And the other thing that's very, very gratifying is that for every single book I've written, I've had somebody tell me it was my absolute best book and somebody tell me it was my absolute worst book. So I think that's pretty good.
Well, with Colin's book,
mm-hmm.
the first chapter is my favorite first chapter of any book of any romance ever. It's the one where Penelope had a crush on.
Oh, so the prologue.
Yeah, and I was reading and I was like, this is so fantastic. And I couldn't. I loved the book so much that I didn't want to get to the end because I knew that.
So nice.
I was like, oh, 10 more pages. It's going to finish really soon.
You know, I think the thing about that book, Romancing Mr. Bridgerton, that's really interesting to me is that everyone wanted Colin's book because he was such a charming guy and funny. And I've got so many emails. Oh, we want Colin's story, Colin's story, Colin's story, over and over again. And I don't think people knew who he was going to end up with until that scene in Or From a Gentleman, the scene with Penelope. But even after everybody wanted Colin's story, once the book came out, the reader's response was all about Penelope. And that's a little different for romance because in romance, it seems to me more often you have the reader who falls in love with the hero rather than the reader who identifies with the heroine and puts herself in her shoes. And I think in Penelope, I somehow managed to create a heroine who everybody saw themselves in. I heard from people who said, were you reading my diary in high school? Were you? I mean, and granted, she was 28 at the time of the book, but she just captured something that really resonated with readers. I think we've all had these moments, you know, unless you were the head cheerleader and the most popular girl at school, where you felt like you knew who you were inside and you had absolutely no way to make that known to other people. And I think that's something that hopefully you gain with adulthood. And she never really had been given the chance to figure out how to do that, you know, beyond her very close friends. Even with her family, she never really felt that she knew how to make the outside person match the inside person.
And that's part of what I really loved about Penelope was that she was really smart. She was able to find a way to basically kind of earn money in secret and be independent or work towards independence because she knew that one day she would have to because she couldn't rely on a great marriage. But she was also kind of part of her family and restricted by the constraints put around her by her mother's expectations and her mother's assumptions about her. She wasn't just an independent historical heroine. Mm-hmm. She wasn't just a wallflower. She had all these different facets of her person that she kind of had to negotiate. And I think what I love about Colin is that he saw who she was that nobody else could see. And I think
it took him, 10 years or something. But
yeah, but I mean, within this book.
Yes, right? Yes.
And I think, you know, some of my favorite historical romances are like that. Anne Gracie's The Perfect Rake often comes up as people's favorites as well. And in that one, the hero kind of can't understand why every time he talks about the most beautiful sister, everyone assumes it's the heroine's sister and not her. And he's like, is everyone blind? What's going on with the world? And I think that taps into readers putting themselves in the heroine's shoes.
Yes.
Which, you know, as you said, is kind of unusual because normally we talk about the hero rather than the heroine. And then you did To Sir Philip with Love, which has an overlapping timeline with the end of Romancing Mr. Bridgerton.
Yes.
And I think part of when he was wicked.
Yes.
And you did the overlapping timeline again with The Lost Duke of Wyndham.
But it's a little different. So with the Bridgerton books, that was just horrific planning on my part. And it really didn't come into play until I was writing when he was wicked. To Sir Philip with Love doesn't really overlap with Romancing Mr. Bridgerton. It really takes place right when it ends. Right. When I went to do When He Was Wicked, and I can't remember the details of how this happened now, but this is one of the dangers of writing an 8-book series and not having intended to at the beginning, is that you can suddenly discover that you've written certain things and laid out perhaps certain hints, and then when you get down to actually set up your timeline, discover that you're in big trouble. Were I to do that again, I probably would have figured out some way to maybe move it back. But that one just sort of was kind of semi-accidental, and I'm pretty sure I messed one thing up, and now I can't remember what, but I tried really hard. Two Dukes of Wyndham was a totally different thing. So that was very much a planned thing. And that came about years and years earlier. I had just, there's a song by the Dire Straits called Industrial Disease that I love. And there's a line in it which always kind of struck me as really interesting. And the line is, two men say they're Jesus. One of them must be wrong. And I just thought that was so funny because it's quite obvious they're both wrong. But, you know, logically speaking, you can only guarantee that one's wrong. But, of course, since I'm a romance author, I immediately thought, well, two men say they're the Duke of something. One of them must be wrong, right? And then I thought, well, wait a minute. I mean, how could two people actually think they're the Duke? Because that's usually it's pretty clear who the Duke of whatever is. And so it was always in the back of my mind. And, you know, once I ended up in the Bridgerton series, everything got put on the back burner because that just went on for so long. And finally I thought, well, I wonder if I could think of a story where who the true Duke is really is in doubt. And then once I started getting a story, I was thinking, okay, well, who's the bad guy and who's the good guy? And then I thought, well, what if they're both good guys? That actually makes it much more interesting. And real, because conflict happens all the time between two good people. And it makes choices and story, everything trickier. And so then I thought, well, if I have two good guys, then I need to write two romances. And so I thought, well, okay, well, now I'm going to have these two romances, and the romances will be completely independent, but they share the same external plot, which is which of these two men really is the Duke of Wyndham. And at that point, I realized I was going to have to write the stories simultaneously because they were taking place at the same time. And normally, if you have secondary characters in your book, you can make your secondary characters do whatever it is you need them to do to support the main story. But if your secondary characters are having their own story at the exact same time, you can't do that because you'll write yourself into the corner like I discovered with When He Was Wicked. So I wrote the books at the exact same time, kind of moving up, you know, side by side. I'd have two windows open on my screen and I'd write one and work on the other. And then when I would get to a scene where everybody was in attendance, I'd be going back and forth because I had to make sure the dialogue matched. So, I mean, if you look at the scenes where characters from both books are, the dialogue will match precisely, although there will be times when maybe part of the dialogue won't appear in the book because maybe the person in whose point of view you are didn't hear something, or you know, they were thinking about something else, looking somewhere else. But if it's within the quotes, it's the same.
Did you find that there was a different reaction?
Yes.
From readers?
Yes. Readers either loved it or hated it. And the ones who hated it really hated it.
One of the comments that I've read, you know, some readers didn't like the fact that there was repetition, because mm-hmm. if it's happening at the same time, then you're obviously going to have the same conversations from different points of view, which I actually found really interesting because, mm-hmm. you know, you can have people say things, but the interpretation of what they said is
totally different.
You know, depends on who's hearing it. But I can also understand that if you're a reader and things are familiar, that you might find that a bit
off-putting. Right. And I thought it was very, very interesting because for me, romance novels are really about the character and the love story. And of course, the plot is very interesting, but it's kind of secondary. And I discovered through this process that it's actually very important to a lot of readers. And so many, many readers are saying, like, I already knew what was going to happen. And part of me is thinking, like, well, you know, it's a romance novel. I mean, part of it, you know, we always know it's going to end happily. And then also for me, I mean, the primary thing still was the romance, not, you know, the answer to this question. Of course, that is different in each book. And there's a very different conflict, romantic conflict in each book. So that was interesting to me. And I was not necessarily expecting that.
But, you know, it's also great that you experiment with, it's not so much the structure, but the storytelling method. Mm-hmm. Because it's not really often that we see that in romance. In romance, I mean, I hate to say that it's formulaic because it's really not. Mm-hmm. As you said, each story stands on its own and is different. But also, you
know, there are constraints.
Yeah, and there's a romance is a tradition, mm-hmm. And it has, you know, writers' groups that sort of mentor each other. So there's a certain sense where the production of romance stories can sometimes have very, very common elements.
Yes.
Just because people are learning it the same way.
Well, one thing I've discovered is that, you know, certainly at this point in my career, I still very much enjoy writing books set in the Regency period.
Oh, thank God.
And I enjoy writing romances. And I don't want to change the setting. I don't really want to change what I'm writing. Okay. But at the same time, I need to keep things interesting for me. Because if I get bored writing a book, I think you're going to get bored reading that book. And I've discovered that if I'm not prepared to change what I'm writing, what I need to do to keep things fresh for me as a writer is to occasionally change how I write. which is why, you know, The Two Dukes of Wyndham was such a wonderful thing for me, because I was able to sort of attack those books in a very different way, and learn lots of different things. So that was great. It was hard. I would never do it again. It was, I think the outline, the joint outline for the books took 17 drafts. I kept switching who ended up with whom, which is kind of funny.
Okay, yeah. I was also going to ask how much of that was kind of, how much of the decisions that you made about the characters, the plot, were off the cuff, and how much you knew before you started writing it.
For those two books, probably I knew a lot more at the beginning than most, just because I had to, with four characters to work with.
But did you already know who the real Duke was going to be, or did you keep sort of changing your mind?
Well, I kept changing my mind when during the, just during the outline stage. Okay. Once I actually started writing the books, I knew. And the whole process was very interesting because, you know, one of the comments I got, you know, the negative comments I got, and I don't mind reading negative reviews. I sort of feel like, you know, if I put a book out there and I publish it and I expect people to pay for it, you're kind of entering a social contract that, you know, they can say what they want about it. The one thing that really kind of got me with the read response to that is when some people called me lazy. They said, I know why she did it. She's lazy because she just wrote the same book twice. And I felt like saying, oh, no. I'm like, tell me you didn't like it. Tell me it was a piece of crap, but don't call me lazy because this was so hard to do. Yeah, but I'm glad I did it. And it's the same reason I do things like the collaborations with Eloisa James and Connie Brockway, because again, it's a very different way to approach a book. And the Bridgerton second epilogues it was fun to work in a shorter format, in something that doesn't follow a traditional romance storyline. So I could do something in the first person. I could do all sorts of different things.
Did you have those professionally edited, or were they sort of, you just wrote them?
Oh, no. It's all, I didn't self-publish.
The originals?
No. They actually were, the first two Bridgerton second epilogues were the very first two, as far as I know, I mean, I've been told, e-books ever published by HarperCollins.
Okay.
So they were a big, I was way ahead of my time. It was a
You're
big,
pioneer.
I know, it was a big, it was a brave new world then.
Was the backlash from that too, I remember, because
there
people
was.
Were like, oh, we've already bought the book and now she wants us to buy the epilogues. And I always thought, you know, there are some readers that would pay like more just to get a little bit more.
It was funny because, I mean, again, it was, you know, who knew what to price things? Nobody knew. Yeah. It was all up in the air. And I read some comments. Some people actually figured out what the price per word was, you know, comparing that to a novel or to a novella or whatever. And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness.
So, I mean, we're from Australia. So books for us, print book is like $30, really. The mass markets used to be around 17. And I think they're now down to 12 because of, you know, they've had to drop the prices due to overseas competition. So, and ebooks are, I mean, anything below 10 and the reader's already winning, basically.
Even for what is the equivalent of a mass market paperback?
I think those would be about six. It would still be more expensive than what a US reader would expect to pay. So whenever we see these complaints, we're like, $3? That seems really, really cheap. You know, why are you complaining about $5? We would kill to be able to buy books for $5. But the other thing is also that this calculation of how much you get for $3, and it's kind of...
It was $2,
I $2,
have to say.
$2,
sorry. That's
okay. I wasn't...
Well, it might have been $3 for you. No, I know.
But, you know, it's like, oh, how much is it per word? How much is it per page? And I always find, you know, how much... But what's the true value of this book?
It was really interesting because one person finally said, it was a reader, I don't know who, just said, you know, it still costs less than going to getting a latte at you know, Starbucks. And
cost more in terms of, in terms of effort to produce than a cup of coffee.
Yeah, and so it was just very interesting, I think, because there wasn't that much in the way of short form ebooks. Nobody knew quite what to make of it. Pretty much all that was out there, you know, were, you know, the shorts by Alora's Cave at the time.
And those were niche as well.
Yeah, I was kind of gobsmacked by the whole thing.
But so what made you decide to re-release it in a compiled version?
Well, it was always the plan to do that.
Okay.
So they came about really because I would just hear from readers saying, well, what happened to this? Did Francesca have a baby? And did, what were in the letters in The Duke and I? Why did this? Blah, blah, blah. And I don't know. If I don't have to bring the characters back as secondary characters in another book, honestly, I don't really think about them.
Yeah. So you're not the kind of author who thinks of their Christmas gifts for their characters.
I do not. I guess it really came about when I wrote the ending for It's in His Kiss, which I don't want to give things away for people, but the main character, the heroine, has been looking for these diamonds for a long time. They're hidden in a house.
Such a cheeky ending.
Yeah, it was a cheeky ending. I won't give it away, but I thought the ending was perfect.
Well, so did I, actually.
Thank you. I was like, ooh, you know, she has a kid just like her. And some people were like, oh my gosh, how could you do that? People were like irate and thinking.
Oh, really? I always thought it was so funny.
I thought it was so funny, so perfect. But then I thought, okay, well, you know, I owe it to Hyacinth to let her find those diamonds eventually. And so I thought, that's when I kind of got the idea of writing these second epilogues. And I took the idea to my publishing house, and they didn't really get it at first. And I don't blame them.
It is a bit. Like, how do you pitch a second epilogue?
Well, you know, and this, it was probably like 2004, 2005 when I was just talking about it with them, and there were no e-readers. E-books were still really these crazy things that, you know, nobody even knew how to read. And, but at the time I had said, you know, I wanted to publish them as a collection, and they said, okay, we'll do it. But I could tell they didn't, it wasn't working. So I said, you know, don't worry about it. Honestly, don't worry about it. I think I'll just do it, and I'll publish them, you know, as 99-cent downloads or something. Thought, well, you know, I can figure out how to do that on the web. It'll, you know, it'll take me, you know, a week or a month or whatever to figure out the technology, but I can do it. And then within days, they came back and like, well, if you want to e-publish it, we could e-publish it. And so I ended up e-publishing it with them. And the idea always was that when I finally got all eight done, we would put them together in a paperback collection. And it took longer for me to get to all eight than I had initially anticipated. I mean, I thought I was going to do two a year, but then didn't quite
that would
well
be
per year. And the thing is, writing, say, you know, 35 pages or whatever, and a novel is 350 pages, writing that epilogue usually takes, it's 1/10 the pages, but it usually takes, you know, maybe 1/20 the time. It's just because it's shorter. It's hard to explain. Once you figure out what you're going to do with the epilogue, they go up very, very quickly.
So why do you think readers, and especially historical readers, I think, love epilogues so much? Because, you know, you always get these readers who are like, I hate epilogues. And
well, I think it's just,
love epilogues.
It was just a little bit more of the, you know, happily ever after. I mean, you sort of end the story when everything's, like, resolved and wonderful, and then you're just like, oh, and let me just give you a little treat so you can see everybody's doing.
And I guess that's how fan fiction kind of takes off as well. It's kind of like an extended epilogue.
Yeah, people sort of wonder, well, what, you know, how are they all doing? Because they really like the characters. And if you look at the fact that, you know, the whole second epilogues came about because so many people were asking me, how are the characters doing? Well, of course they're going to want the little epilogue. Yeah. And so the second epilogues were just a way to give readers a little treat. My Lisa Kleypas, who's a friend of mine, once said, she said, it's like a box of chocolates for your readers. Yeah. You know, and I tried to explain to people, you know, they're not designed to hook new readers.
It's like a reward.
Yeah, it's like just a little, yeah, I really like doing them.
At the moment, you're writing a quartet.
Mm-hmm. The Smythe-Smith Quartet.
Smith Quartet, who were introduced in your earlier books through their musical performances.
The world's worst amateur musicians. Yeah. And, you know, they came about, actually, the first book they were in was Minx, which was my third book. I now know a lot about the Smythe-Smiths and their appearances in my books, because before I could begin any of the books in this quartet, I had to research my own books to figure out what the heck I'd said about them.
Right.
And what they came about because I needed some sort of thing where my hero and heroine would be at some sort of society function where they could talk a little bit. And I decided to make it a musicale so they could sit next to each other. And then I thought, well, it should be really bad music because that's funnier than good music.
Yeah.
And
had you had readers asking you for books about them?
I had. And what's really funny is that, you know, there are a few. And when I set it up in Minx, I thought, oh, I sort of set it up so that maybe I could write one book. And then I got sidetracked by a bunch of other stuff. And it was really funny. Like, all of a sudden, I think it, you know, maybe like one or two people per year would ask something. And then all of a sudden, it was just steamrolling. And I was getting all these readers just saying, what about them? What about them? What about them? And so when I
was that after Hyacinth's book? Because it was it Hyacinth's book where she says, you know, I watch it because of that one girl who looks miserable.
I think it was that one. That was in, but it really picked up, I think, after What Happens in London.
Okay.
Because they're back at another musicale there, and then people were just asking, you know, all the time, and I thought, okay, well, but that was a challenge too, because, you know, how do you write about a bunch of girls who are up there playing really bad music and looking like they don't realize it's bad?
Yeah.
So So that was a little challenging. But three books are now written. Two are out. The third one comes out in the United States at the end of October. And that's The Sum of All Kisses. And then...
So tell us a little bit about the book that's coming out in October.
Well, that features Sum of All Kisses features two characters you've met. Sarah, Lady Sarah Plensworth, who has been in the first two books. And she is a cousin to Honoria and Daniel Smythe-Smith, who were the heroine and hero of the first two books. And Hugh Prentice, who has also been featured in the books, who had a duel with Daniel 3.5 years before the book starts that left him injured. And he's kind of this enigmatic character. I don't know that I initially had planned him to come out that way, but he sort of emerged as this really interesting character. So I put them together. And that was a bit of a challenge because it's very difficult when you write a book that features two established secondary characters.
So did you know that they were going to be in future books when you wrote them into the first two books?
Well, I always knew Sarah would get a book because the idea was that it would be for the family from the quartet, the four people playing in the quartet. And I didn't want them all to be... I was trying to make things interesting. So, for example, the second book isn't... The heroine's not a Smythe-Smith. She's the governess who has to stand in when Sarah bails and runs out on her family and is like, I won't perform. But, you know, she performed in a Smythe-Smith quartet, so she can get in there too. And then Sarah... And then the last book will be Iris, who's been in the quartets. So the only sort of performing Smythe-Smith who's not going to get a book is Daisy, who's been in there too, because she has no sense of humor, so I can't write about her.
But Hugh is mentioned in the first book.
Yeah, and the second. And I don't know. Definitely during the second book, I realized I wanted to do something with him.
Did you have a fully fledged backstory for him in the first book, or was he just kind of really a character that?
No, I did not have a fully fled. Yeah, no, he wasn't set up really in the first book.
You mentioned humor in your books, which is a really big feature of your, I guess, your voice. I'm assuming that comes naturally to you because I also heard your keynote, which is very interesting and filled with humor as well. I always find it curious to know how authors draw the line with humor because you can sort of go too far and then it becomes too kind of slapstick. It can be too dry and then it becomes sarcastic. And it's kind of, to me, it actually requires kind of a sensitive touch to be able to do humor that appeals to many people.
I don't know.
It's a talent.
People who know me, you know, personally will say that when they read my books, they're like, it's so clear it's you. It's just so obvious that you're writing this. It's your voice comes out. And that's not the case with all writers. Some writers, their personal voice is very different than their writing voice. And so for me, I think because mine matches so closely, I don't know that I could write books really any other way.
But you also insert yourself into the book as like a kind of an author narrator.
Sometimes I'll put in, you know, sort of the omniscient narrator. Usually it's just at the very beginning of the book.
To set it up,
which is kind of fun. But it doesn't carry through the whole story in a big way. Sometimes I'll do books with, you know, little epigraphs at the beginning where it says, in which our hero and heroine, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And that's just fun for me.
But I think that's part of the appeal because then we feel like we're talking to the person who's writing the book.
Oh, that's nice.
It's you feel kind of closer to the author, like, hey, we're telling this story. Oh, I'm telling this story. Come and sort of share it with me. Because I know, I don't know, at least in the previous years, I don't know if it's still kind of the fashion at the moment where, you know, you have to be very close into the character's point of view. You must never kind of break that point of view. You must never head hop, which in historical romance, I think probably isn't as strict. I find that I don't notice it as much in historical romance.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's because we kind of are used to these sort of narrations in between scenes.
Could be, yeah.
I wanted to go back to writing books with different tones because we didn't really talk about When He Was Wicked, which was the kind of the Bridgerton book that didn't really sound like a Bridgerton book. That's how kind of I think about it. And it's also a book that features a love story that isn't a typical love story for historical romance. She's a widow who'd been happily married before. The only thing that I remember wondering about there was, you know, in romance we tend to be like, oh, this is the hero and the heroine, they will have the best sex ever. Because that's kind of a signal that they are...
A pair.
The couple. I wondered how hard that was to manage that expectation when you're writing about a heroine who'd been happy before. who'd had, you know, like fairly satisfying sex before mm-hmm. in a marriage, and now she's moving on to a new relationship.
Well, the biggest thing really was that I knew I wasn't going to show her in bed with her first husband. That wasn't going to be part of the story. The tricky thing about that book, and the thing that was different, and I haven't seen it in another romance novel, but I felt it was really important to do, was that the first four chapters, there are really two parts to the book, and the first four chapters occur when she's still married to John, and then just shortly after his death. And there were some editorial concerns about that maybe I should begin really when Michael's story begins, to make it clear he's the hero of the story and that sort of thing. But Michael was the cousin and best friend of her first husband, and he had been in love with Francesca, even though she was married to his cousin, and he felt tremendous guilt over that.
But I love that as well.
Yeah, but the point is that, and I didn't think that the conflict that he and Francesca are facing, which is almost exclusively internal conflict, of getting over the death of somebody who's so dear to them and feeling guilty about wanting the other person who's still alive, I didn't think it was going to feel real if I hadn't shown who John was and how much they both loved him and how important he was. And I felt like if I opened the book, you know, right when Francesca and Michael's love story begins, then it would sort of be like, you know, telling, not showing. And I just felt that the book was going to be made so much deeper and more special if you saw that, what happened in the beginning and why they felt the way they did.
I have a reader friend who didn't read historical, so we were kind of throwing all these favorite historical romances mm-hmm. At her to see, you know, thinking that one of these will appeal to you. And mm-hmm. she ended up reading your entire series, and that book is actually her favorite out of the whole thing. And I know that it also got mixed reviews from readers precisely because mm-hmm. of the things that we had just talked about.
Well, actually, you know, for a lot of people, it is their favorite. And I think when it is someone's least favorite, it tends to be, I think the readers who didn't really like it as well, it's just because it wasn't what they were expecting. Because it was a very different sort of book for me. And again, I like to do things differently sometimes.
And I wonder if that's also a product of the fact that it's part of a series.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of a series, but also, you know, I think in addition to it being a Bridgerton book, it's still a Julia Quinn novel. And I think people have certain expectations, you know, with writers of what they're going to get when they pick up a certain novel. And I think it still fulfills what you would a Julia Quinn novel should be. I mean, there's still lots of humor in it. It's still very dialogue heavy, but it has a lot more sadness than most of my novels. And it's actually a little sexier than most of my novels too, which made sense because she's, you know, she's a right. widow. She knows what goes on. And so in some ways, and there's a lot more tragedy. The characters have some bad things happen to them before they get to the end. So it's just, it wasn't quite what they were expecting.
So after the Smythe Smith series, have you thought of what you're going to do?
I have no idea. I know that there's some authors who have things planned out so far in advance. I got to figure out what to do with this book, and then I'll figure
Quarters and Heroines became very popular recently. Yeah, is that something that appeals?
That doesn't... I mean, I would never say never, because if I could figure out the right sort of thing, it would be great, but it doesn't really appeal to me. I just have difficulty figuring out the right way to do that.
I have one last question.
Sure.
How much does historical accuracy matter in a romance novel?
Well, I think it matters a great deal, but you have to remember different romance novels have very different levels of sort of immersion in the history. I write what are called costume dramas, in which you have purely fictional characters, and they are set in a setting that is a real time period, but the politics of the time don't come into play in a big way. So it's really sort of, I guess, sort of the best comparison would be something like Downton Abbey. I mean, yes, you've got World War I going on in the background and the characters do go to the war and whatever, but it's not like these characters are intimately involved with changing history. And then the next level up would be one where it's a historical romance, but you've got the characters mingling with real people. So like, you know, if suddenly they're talking with the Prince Regent and he becomes an integral character. And then finally, there's one where the main characters are real people. Then you are fictionalizing history. And so since I write sort of the least historical type of that, I still need to be accurate, but I guess what I'm saying is I don't have as many facts to be accurate about. This isn't to say that I haven't messed up, because I'm sure I have. And also, you know, I'm writing for a modern audience, right. So I need, you know, the sentence structure and a lot of things like that will be more readable to a modern audience. But I do try. And it's funny, the things that you get caught up on trying to check are things that are so minor to the book, you know, and things that, you know, I'll end up spending 3 hours trying to find out something crazy like the provenance of a certain painting. Like, where was this painting in 1812? And is there any way this character could have seen it in person? And you're thinking,
oh. Well, I know some readers who actually just consider the historical background as part of a fantasy. Mm-hmm. That we have had so many historical romances that we've kind of built a historical romance set of conventions around that time period,
oh,
which
sure.
may or may not be accurate. And actually, if you try to be more accurate, then readers will think that you are not correct.
I have had people correct me on certain things where not only were they wrong, I actually knew why they thought I was wrong, and I knew exactly which novel they picked it up from, because I read that book. And so that's, you know, and I, you know, you don't want to write back to them and say something like, well, I know you read this book, and she said this, and that's just wrong. But you do make mistakes. Yeah, so it's, I do think there's a certain level of fantasy to
and
it.
Would you ever write sort of in a different time period, either even just slightly after, slightly before the Regency?
Well, a number of my books are slightly after the Regency, okay. And that happened, you know, not necessarily on purpose, but just because I ended up with this 8-book series and the characters had to move through time. And so when I got to the Smiths, actually, I did all this research to figure out, okay, how many years have they been doing this? And then I had to figure out, well, which previous appearance do I want them to coincide with? And so it ended up, they were coinciding with around It's in His Kiss and Romancing Mr. Bridgerton, those ones. So I had to set it around 1824, I guess, to begin with. So it is a little bit after. I would never say never. I don't see veering off it too much right now, but yeah, I don't know.
That's all we have time for in this episode. For the show notes, go to bookthingo.com.au/podcast and click on episode number 3. The notes will include links to all the books and other awesome things we mentioned today. The audio for this podcast was produced by our audio producer, Rudy Bremer. In the next episode of the podcast, I chat with author Ainsley Payton and academic Jody McAllister about, oh, so many things. That episode will be available on bookthingo.com.au, iTunes, and Stitcher very soon. If you're using a podcast app, you can subscribe to the Book Thingo podcast to ensure that you don't miss an episode. And if you do enjoy the podcast and feel moved to rate it on iTunes, I will not only be grateful, I will eat a Tim Tam on your behalf.